Hey guys, welcome to the C-Spec version of the Race Car Podcast. I'm your host, Curtis. So, you know, before I get into the BT-52, just give me a second to just tell you a little bit about what I'm going to be doing here and who I am. So, the Race Car Podcast started out as this thing. I was going to use a random number generator to select the car for me. Eventually, I binned it and decided, all right, you know what? There's enough cool cars out there to tell the story of that. I'm just going to pick one. We'll go from there. I'm going to try to vary it. You know, we're into the Formula One season now, so I'm going to be doing some Formula One stuff, but, you know, we'll get into Le Mans, we'll get into World Rally, we can get an old NASCAR if you want. I don't really, you know, all that stuff's cool. So, like I said, I'm no sort of expert. I drive a lumber truck. Most of my research for this podcast I do on my lunch break while I'm at work, or I might do it at home. I have a microphone down here in my basement. I also have a microphone that I can plug right into my iPhone. So if I'm on break at work, I can record the podcast right in the truck. So I guess I was kind of fortunate that I get to record this one in my basement. So like I said, I'm not an expert, just a guy that likes cars. I'm sure I'm probably going to miss stuff, you know, miss details about cars and whatnot. So if anybody feels like correcting me on stuff, feel free. Also, you know, this is literally the first podcast I've ever recorded. So constructive criticism and stuff on that, and like how it sounds and how it's put together, feel free. You'd be doing nothing but helping me. So grabbing BT-52, let's get into it. So I said in the trailer for this podcast that the podcast is going to be exactly what it sounds like, and that premise makes the BT-52 a pretty good car to start with, because the Brabham BT-52 looks more like a race car than any car that has ever come before or after it. It's like the race car equivalent of when you have a friend that's acting really loud and boisterous and you kind of have to say, hey man, take it down a notch, people are looking at you. It looks like if a 1980s Formula One car went to a county fair and had somebody draw a caricature of it. Specifically to look at the car, it looks like an arrow. It kind of has this pointy nose at the front. It's got just a thin body at the middle. And then right before the rear tires is where the entire car happens. There's really no side pods in the middle. But to understand why the car looks like this, we kind of have to look at the previous year. So by 1982, Formula One was in the middle of their first turbo era, but it was also their ground effect era. So ground effect is an aerodynamic phenomenon which is pioneered in Formula One by Lotus with the 78. To kind of put it shortly, ground effect worked by creating a low pressure area under the floor that literally sucked the car down onto the track. It did this by shaping the underside of the side pods like wings, but turned over. So this accelerated the flow of air under the car and created a vacuum relative to the air above the car, which created downforce. So because you were making your downforce under the car instead of above it, it also had the side effect of allowing the designers to reduce drag. So for a good example of this, you can actually take a look at 1980s Brabham BT-49, because it didn't have any front wing on it at all. And the rear wing on the car was real small, and it was mounted way down low. So they're making so much downforce under the car with the ground effect that they just kind of said, yeah, wings, who needs them? So ground effect increased cornering speed. It did have its issues. If the floor of the car got too close to the ground, it would effectively just squeeze out all the air under the car, and you'd get an almost instant and almost total loss of downforce. Another negative for ground effect was that on a wet track, the aero forces tended to move the water through the side pods and turn it into a fog more than a spray. So at the 82 German Grand Prix, this was a contributing factor to Didier Pironi's crash, which had to actually break both of his legs and end his Formula One career. What was not the cause of Gilles Villeneuve's death at Zolder in 82, the Belgian Grand Prix, those two incidents did lead to a focus by the FIA on driver safety for 1983. For this reason, the FIA mandated flat floors going forward on the cars, which effectively banned ground effect. So prior to the ban, Brabham owner Bernie Eccleston, and if you're a Formula One fan, that's a name you're familiar with, Brabham was actually how Bernie got into Formula One. Some people kind of thought that, you know, from the beginning, he really just wanted to own Formula One, the entity, but Gordon Murray actually said Bernie was a racer, and Bernie just always wanted to own a Formula One team, and Brabham was his opportunity to do so. So Bernie was confident the ground effect would not be banned, so he had instructed Gordon Murray, who you might also know, later he worked for McLaren, and in fact was the designer of the McLaren F1 road car. So he had Gordon continue developing a ground effect car for 1983, which was the BT-51. But because that car was built so heavily around ground effect, there really wasn't an effective way to convert it to use the 83 regulations. So Gordon Murray went back to the drawing board to draw up an entirely new car. An advantage Murray did have in the new design was one of packaging. The engine in the car was the BMW M1213, which we'll get into the details of shortly. So because the BMW is a four-cylinder, it ran only a single turbocharger and made less heat than Ferrari and Renault's V6 twin-turbo engines. Knowing this, Murray was able to run smaller radiators and intercooler than Brabham's competitors. All this meant that Murray was able to take the weight of the car and push it to the back, putting the weight of the car's heaviest components squarely over the drive wheels. And with the massive power that the BMW engine would make, the car is really going to need all the traction it could get. The result was a look like nothing else on the grid. While most everybody else still had like the long side pods in between the wheels, Brabham side pods didn't even start until behind the driver next to the fuel tank, almost all the way back to the rear wheels. Speaking of that fuel tank, Murray and Brabham had come up with a little bit of trickery there, or what Gordon Murray liked to refer to as the unfair advantage. The previous year on the BT50, Brabham had experimented with the concept of the strategic pit stop. Tire changes were commonplace in Formula One at the time, but nobody was doing mid-race refueling. Murray concluded that if they ran only the fuel needed for a stint, rather than a full 220 liters, they'd win every race going away because the time gained on track was worth the time of refueling. They came up with a rig that would fuel the car at 5 bar pressure, capable of adding 30 gallons in only 3 seconds. This allowed Brabham to run a smaller fuel tank, reducing weight and lap times. On top of that, they developed pneumatic jacks built into the car, tire warmers, improved wheel nuts, and guns to shorten the time of their stops. All this was put on trial for the last 4 races in 1982, or at least they attempted to put it on trial. Brabham bought their full pit stop setup to the last 4 races, but the unreliability of the BMW engine, just to say the BT50s retired in 16 of 23 total races they started in 1982, meant they only actually got to try a pit stop once, and the engine promptly blew up shortly thereafter. Murray was convinced of the concept, though, so everything was baked into BT52 from the start. He was also convinced all the other team would have taken notice of the strategy and showed up for 83 with what he called half-tank cars. Fortunately for Brabham, he was wrong on that count. Only Williams would make an attempt in that form of a kit to convert their car, which is not the whole pit stop system like Brabham had developed. Additionally, the car was designed to be modular and easy to work on. The whole rear section of the car, that is to say the engine, gearbox, radiators, intercoolers, and the whole rear suspension could be detached from the monocoque as one unit. The mechanics could build a whole new rear section and just swap the unit in the event of failure, rather than have to dig the engine out of the chassis by itself. BT52 also extended Brabham's use of carbon fiber in their cars. It was used in the monocoque, riveted and bonded to the aluminum to add strength. The car had carbon brakes, which Brabham had been using for several years already at that point, and is the first Formula One car to use carbon fiber for its roll hoop. By the way, all this brand new design work on the BT52, this car went from Gordon Murray's drawing board to the Brabham shop floor in only 6 weeks. Murray has also said it was the least aerodynamically adjustable car he's ever built, with only front flap adjustments for balancing. So after the Canadian Grand Prix, the car was updated to its B-spec form, the main change there being the addition of winglets on the sides of the rear wing. It's also easily identified by livery change. Where the car was white and blue to start the season, the livery was reversed on the BT52B. The main sponsor of the car was Parmalat, which I always kind of assumed when I was growing up was like a European cigarette company or something, so I was more than a little surprised to find out that it's a French dairy concern, which would not have been one of my first 5 guesses. So now we get to probably what's my favorite part of the car, which is what was hiding away in the back of it, the BMW M1213 engine. The M12 was the work of Paul Rauscher, or Camshaft Paul as he was called within BMW, because of his skill at calculating camshaft profiles. Rauscher had developed a number of BMW performance engines, including the M31, found in the BMW 2002 Turbo, the M1's M88, and the E30 M3's S13. Perhaps his best-known work, however, was also part of Gordon Murray's best-known work, was the S70/2V12 that powered the McLaren F1 road car. The M12 itself is actually, it dates back to the M10 engine, which is a 1.5-liter four-cylinder single cam, which makes about 80 horsepower. This engine was also a Rauscher creation, one of his first jobs at BMW, and it went into production in 1962. He had turbocharged a 1.4-liter variant of their DRM engine to FIA Group 5 specs for BMW's 320i program. The DRM was the forebearer to the current German DTM series. He and BMW Motorsports director at the time, Jochen Nierpasch, saw the promise of, if I'm mispronouncing German names, it's going to happen, all right? So, whatever. Saw the promise of the engine and sought to ally with Niki Lauda and McLaren for the 1980 Formula One season, but BMW's board denied the request, resulting in Nierpasch leaving the company. Nierpasch went to work for Talbot, who was entering Formula One with the French Ligier team, and brokered a deal for them to buy Rauscher's engine design. Rauscher and his new boss, Dieter Stappert, protested to the board that because the M1213 was a production-based engine, which BMW could use in advertising, it should be a BMW Works effort to enter Formula One. This time the board agreed, and they entered into an agreement with Brabham. The M10 was actually kind of oddly suited to this job. The M1213 only needed to displace 1.5 liters, and the M10 could handle up to 2 liters of displacement, so the block walls still had plenty of meat on them in 1.5 liter configuration. It was also an over-square design, with a bore of 89.2 millimeters to a 60 millimeter stroke, which lent itself to high RPM, low torque kind of applications like this. In fact, the red line on the engine ended up being 11,500 RPM. Initially, with 40 pounds of boost, the engines make 650 horsepower or so. Later versions and qualifying trim pushing 80 pounds of boost would make upwards of 1,300 horsepower. The exact figure isn't known because, as Paul Rocha said, it must have been 1,400 horsepower, but we don't know the exact figure because the engine dynamometer didn't go beyond 1,280 horsepower. BMW would be directly involved in Formula 1 with Brabham from 82 until 87, and in 87 and 88 with the Arrows team. However, and this is important, when in Arrows, the engine was badged not as a BMW, but as a Megatron, which is pretty clearly the superior engine name here. The whole idea of the M12 is actually kind of hilarious to me, and something that's just spectacularly 80s. I like to imagine Paul Rocha walking around the parking lot in Munich, seeing an M10-powered 1600 New Class and thinking, yeah, we can make 750 horsepower here. All we need to do is bolt a gen engine-sized turbo to it, turn 12,000 RPM, and, you know, it's fine. We'll be mint. I remember hearing a story from Derek Warwick, who actually drove a later version of the car with this engine, and he would talk about the turbo lag. And basically, you had to plant the throttle when you were mid-turn because it took about 2 full seconds for the turbo to actually spool up and for the car to make any power. As such, M12-powered cars were generally better on power circuits than they were on tight circuits. There's a couple interesting bits about how they made the engines, mainly that BMW preferred to use old engine blocks for the M1213. Because the block was based on stock M10, BMW had access to plenty of used engines. I actually preferred engines with over 60,000 miles, figuring that any imperfections would have shown themselves by that point. Basically, what BMW was saying here was when they put the entire crankshaft through the side of the block, it was going to be because of 80 pounds of boost, not because of faulty metallurgy. You know, in this case, basically, windowing the side of the block was going to be a feature, not a bug. BMW also seasoned the blocks by basically just leaving them out in a pile behind the shop, exposed to the elements to toughen up. They may have also peed on them. Truly, the 1980s was our finest time. Anyway, though, Brabham wasn't the only car on the track in 83. So as to Brabham's main competition, it really came down to Ferrari and Renault. Their approaches to the season both differed heavily from Brabham's, resulting in three very different cars competing for the championship. Renault began the season with the RE30C, with Alan Prost running it in the first race, and his teammate Eddie Cheever running it in the first two before his RE40 was ready. The 30C was just a flat-bottom version of the previous year's 30B, but with larger wings. The RE40 was a more conventionally styled racer than the BT52, with regular side pods and pointed nose. It's actually a pretty handsome car if you go and take a look at it. It was also Renault's first chassis constructed entirely from carbon fiber. Power came from Renault's twin-turbo Gordini V6, and while Renault was the pioneer of turbo engines in Formula 1, they've been running them since the RS01 in 1977, they really hadn't gotten a handle on reliability. Ferrari brought the 126C2B and 126C3 for 1983. The team were coming off a difficult, albeit successful, 82 season where they lost both of their drivers, Villeneuve and Pironi, who we mentioned earlier, but still managed to win the Constructor Championship. The 126C3 was a modified version of 82's championship-winning car with a flat bottom and larger wings. So, Brabham comes out with an all-new car that shared literally nothing with the previous year's car, not even a tire supplier. It was built in a month and a half. They had an engine that only finished 7 races the year previous, a whole plan built around pit stop strategy nobody had ever tried with equipment that they had just invented that year. They faced off against last year's champions Ferrari and the team with the most knowledge of turbos in Renault. So what could possibly go wrong? And shockingly, the answer to that is not nearly as much as you would think. So if there was one thing that Brabham definitely had going for them entering the season, it was that they had a really good pair of drivers. They had the Brazilian former world champion Nelson Piquet, who was driving the number 5 car, and the Italian Riccardo Patrese driving the 6 car. Piquet had been driving for Brabham since the end of 78, where he won the 81 championship, and he's won 7 races along the way. Patrese was entering his second season for Brabham, having just won the first race of his career for them in 82 at Monaco. Piquet would win the first race of the season in Brazil, wouldn't win another race until he went back-to-back in the 13th and 14th rounds of the season at Monza and Brands Hatch, respectively. Entering the 15th and final round of the season, he'd trail Renault's Alain Prost by 2 points in the championship. Prost would retire from the race, Piquet finished second, he would take the driver's championship. Patrese had a much more challenging season, retiring in 10 of the 15 races. He'd win the final race of the season at Kyalami, but because of the lack of consistency, he would finish the season 10th in points. The low point of the season for him was likely his home Italian Grand Prix. Patrese hadn't been signed for 84 and apparently didn't want to give up a home win to his championship-contending teammate, so he theorized that Brabham simply left his M12-13 in an explodey qualifying spec and let nature take his course. Sure enough, Patrese's engine gave up on lap 3, and Piquet went on to win the race. Brabham ended up finishing 3rd in the Constructors' Championship, with Ferrari taking that honor for the second straight year ahead of Renault. That's essentially the racing career of the Brabham BT52. It wouldn't lead to a car styling revolution. It also wouldn't lead to an immediate era of refueling pit stops, because the FIA would ban refueling in race for 1984. Brabham's 84 car, the BT53, was a variant of the 52, but more conventionally styled. Because refueling had gone away, the car had to carry a full 220-liter tank. The side pods were longer, and while it was quick, scoring 9 poles and 2 wins, the unreliability of the car made sure Piquet would not repeat as champion. Anyway, next time on the Race Car Podcast, we're going to talk about something weird. Even weirder, in fact, than the Brabham. It's the 2015 Nissan GT-R LM Nismo, which is honestly a car that I've been baffled by for 6 years now. So I'm doing this podcast as much for me to feel better about why this car was built and what Nissan was thinking as I am to tell you guys about it. So if you enjoy the show, give me a follow on Twitter. Leave a review if you feel like it. On Twitter, you can find me at Race Car Podcast. If you want to hear about a specific car, feel free to shoot me a DM because I'm always looking for cool cars to talk about. So that's pretty much it. So until next time, guys, thanks for listening.